It's a bit of a puzzle as to what you can or can't grow in water. There's obviously a large income from breeding up aquarium fish. The aquarium trade's very large. And you can put a lot of small fish in ponds and just sell out to the aquarium trade. We might do a little bit of that in small ponds, because the very same fish you're doing that are your forage fish for larger fish too. We've hardly explored the potential of the world's fauna for cultivation, either in water or on land. The large lizards of the Galapagos group are seaweed eaters, and they too are rather rapid growers, and they live quite happily on these rocky coasts, dashing into the sea and eating seaweed occasionally. And those things have arisen on islands in particular, A, because of a limited food resource. They've developed particular skills in using unused foods, and B, because they've been basically predation free and they've been able to occupy niches which are otherwise very difficult to occupy in continental land masses. So when you look on the island, you find all sorts of edible, strange things on islands. New Hebrides is basically unexplored from this sort of point of view. And we don't even know the plants of the New Hebrides. I think we'll see a big change in what is regarded as normal rearing systems, away from beef. Away from chickens, perhaps. I mean, the anaconda may well replace the chicken as far as the table meat goes.
Then why go for root when you get cold with a reptile?
That's even better, isn't it? Yeah. Why bother? Why not go for roos and anacondas? A kangaroo anaconda system would be rather good. Kangaroo is a grasshopper to the anaconda, as it were. The totally unexplored aquaculture, and I mean totally, is the plant aquaculture. There is no book on it. There's not even a reasonable list of the useful aquatic plants until my book comes out. Yeah, that's right, I'm a salesman. The thing is that the aquatic plants are staple foods. Some of the aquatic palms are highest yielding, I think, forest crops we know of. We produce a lot of sugars out of water for bees, nectars, and also for alcohol distillation. Root crop is by far more prolific in water than it is out of water. A good taro will give you 30 pound weight. 3 roots will give you 90. 4 roots is your staple food for the year. That's about as big as the top of that desk. You know, I think we should be doing a lot more small aquatics in our backyards in plants. I would say that there's not a lot of point in rearing fish in anything under something about the size of this corner. And at that, you don't get a lot of your food from that pond. But there's a lot of point in developing that pond for staple aquatic plants, with just fish as just a little side thing. Taro and tilapia go very well together. Snails. A lot of water snails are large, fast-growing, and are eaten. And the ones the Hawaiians call the Philippine snail, because the Filipinos brought it in, is called pu'u. Pu'u, pu'u, hine hine, hine hine. What's that go? Da 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 da, poo. Hine, hine, eh. It's a little bird calling to the snail, come here, little snail. I won't hurt you. Poo-oo. He called to the snail, poo-oo. Poo-oo. Hine, hine. Hine, come here, come here. Then he eats him. Oh, do, 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 do. That's a little Hawaiian song about poo-oo. What do you call those snails? It's like, oh, they smile and look at you and say, poo-oo. The poo-oo is a poo-oo. Hine, hine, poo-oo. Hine, hine, hey. Oh, la, 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 la. I'm getting it. I'm remembering me poo-oo chat. Right. So, snails in water are very good food. Interestingly, the poo-oo goes very well with taro because it doesn't eat taro. It eats the weeds of the taro. Ducks eat the poo-oo. So you've got to keep a sort of poo-oo pond and a duck pond without poo-oo. But poo-oo run down, flow down. So you can put your poo-oo high in the system and your ducks low in the system. Or, more sensibly, put your ducks high in the system and your poo-oo central in the system to mop up the duck manure. So these are about the highest value food in the Hawaiian Islands as a per pint sale system.
What about water chestnut?
Water chestnut, two varieties. The Indian water chestnut, Trapa, occurs naturally in Australia. We have Trapa bicornis. There are 11 species of Trapa, and they extend the range from the true equatorial to this climate. The one that grows here is cultivated widely in Italy. Trapa bicornis, I think it is.
Do you know where you can get it?
Trapa?
As
yet, like most of the useful aquatic plants, there isn't a sort of nursery or market situation set up for Trapa.
Nobody here knows where you can find it?
You can find it in Australia. It's listed in most Australian wild food books or that book on Australian aquatics. But it's a subtropical Trapa. The temperate Trapa hasn't been cultivated here, which is strange because we've had a lot of Italians come in here, and no doubt a few of them have brought some Trapa in. Maybe it's here, maybe it should just simply advertise. The Trapa floats. It needs water 3 feet deep overall. Comes up with little things on it, nice little round leaves, and a very large seed about that big with little soft green spikes on. It gets its name from that. That's those things that they used to throw under horses' hooves, you know. And now you just break them off. It's real soft and eat it, and it's about the best food you can eat. I think it's beautiful food, very crisp. I buy it whenever I'm in India or in Pakistan. You see all these beautiful women out in the ponds up to their waists in water, pushing great big brass bowls along and picking Trapa and putting in, and they'll float a bowl into shore and you can eat your Trapa. Oh, God. It's a life, I tell you. A rental of a quarter acre of Trapa in India is $700 Australian per year. It's a rental paid for a quarter acre Trapa pond. And the income from it's about $1,200 to $1,500 Australian in India. Trapa, of course, goes very well with fish, providing the fish are herbivores. And your water depth is 3 feet. They're planted in November, just pushed into the mud with your feet, and then they come up and they filch seed too if you leave enough Trapa on the crop. The other water chestnut is Eleocharis. This is the one you can get in Australia, and it's very tolerant water chestnut. It'll grow from here to to Cairns. Heliocaris, it's a totally different plant. It's a rush, and it grows in shallow water or even mud. And it forms bulbuls and runners and bulbuls, and it's a straight rush. And it's the small one you buy in Sydney markets fresh. It's a black circular smooth water chestnut. Otherwise, very similar in flavour and texture to the Indian water chestnut.
Is that the one used in Chinese cooking?
This is the one you buy as a Chinese water chestnut. And it's brought to Australia by the Chinese and grown in Australia by the Chinese and on public sale in Sydney at least, and I think in Melbourne. Sometimes you see quite a lot in the market, sometimes none.
What's the animal that comes
up
the root?
The root, the bulb. You dig it with your toes. The other one that grows like this, which we don't seem to grow much, is the arrowheads, Sagittarians, or duck potatoes, which per area out yield potatoes, and they're much nicer than potatoes. I keep, they have runners with continual roots on. You dig those up with your toes too. That's a staple food of the American Indians and also occurs in Australia, but is not brought into cultivation.
This is another shrub.
No, it's Sagittaria or the arrowhead. The leaves are this shape, you know, and that big too. Shallow, muddy ponds, literally edges of ponds. They grow just outside the trapa, the Heliocaris. Heliocaris grows in wet muds, and these things grow in just shallow water. And they don't grow in deep water, so they form double band around shallow ponds, or you can make a pond and grow them right across it if you can flood the pond to a fairly constant depth. Sort of rice paddy appearance. On little mounds in ponds, which are normally flooded, you can grow a thing called kangkong, which is Ipomoea, or one of the Ipomoea. Ipomoea is one of the convolvulus group, I think, isn't it? Ipomoea? Yeah. Convolvulus or one of the yam groups? It's a convolvulus, convolvulaceae. It is, Ipomoea. It's called water convolvulus. Okay. Yeah, this one doesn't put down a root. This kangkong is a green crop for the subtropics. But it's a bit more tolerant than that. It'll come way down the coast, I think probably almost to Melbourne. It's probably one of the most nutritious green crops that we could grow, kangkong. It's planted on mounds in shallows. K-A-N-G-K-O-N-G.
What do you eat the leaves?
You eat the leaves, tips of the plant. It's quite nice to eat fresh, and you also use it lightly steamed as a salad. It analyses better than almost any vegetable. It's one of the more suitable tropical vegetables. We should throw lettuces and cabbages out in the tropics and grow some of these tropic adapted crops which keep high levels of mineral and nutrition in. Kangkong is one of them. Watercress is grown in the same way on mounds in shallow water, or will grow out of shallows and even down to 12 inches deep. So it's more easily managed as a mound plant. Watercress, again, is a high mineral content plant. It's a high nutrition plant, used much more widely and more commonly in Europe than here. In fact, in Europe, the word greens is synonymous with watercress. If you go in and ask for a bunch of greens, it is watercress. Why we don't eat so much watercress, I don't know. Yeah, we've got 3 acres of bloody stuff and we eat maybe one sprig a year. Yeah, I don't think it's good to run cattle with these crops or sheep because you've got E. coli and fluke. And it's better to run your crop as a crop and run your cattle somewhere else. Yeah, you don't really want cattle or sheep amongst your water cropping system. Ducks, of course, they're okay.
Is the lotus aquatic?
Lotus is aquatic. It's a preferred depth of about 12, 15 inches. All parts are edible. It's again on sale in Sydney Market. Fresh lotus heads. You can, and you can grow it in ditches. It doesn't need to be in water. Its ideal location is these little mounds in water, but it's commonly grown throughout the Seychelles just as a ditch plant. Same with Eleocharis. You needn't put it in a pond edge. You just keep a damp soil area and grow Eleocharis at the back door, providing you've got a drip system on it. Yeah, the same with trapa. You can put a drip system onto a patch of, put a beat down a clay patch 12 inches down, saucer some clay up, put good dirt in it, put a drip on it, and you can grow Eleocharis, Kangkong, and taro. Taro you also mulch. In fact, all of these like mulch. Kangkong has another very good characteristic. Kangkong is, if you like, a pioneer plant in water. And you'll often see it anchored with just a bamboo stake driven into it. We haven't got the advanced techniques of water cultures here that you see in the east, in Thailand. For instance, on a shallow riverbank, you'll see logs with a little bit of chain or a bamboo to each log, you see a little log boom. Inside you'll see bamboo stakes. At the bamboo stakes you'll see kangkong tied to the stakes and floating off. In those you throw all your coconut husks and floating mulch. Slowly the kangkong grabs it and consolidates it, and then you start to plant taro. So your kangkong is your consolidator of mulch, water mulch. It just grabs the floating mulch, anchors it, and then you can start to follow that in with your more permanent crop like your Sagittaria and your taro. Taro is only one of its family commonly eaten, although you can eat others. It's a large root, can be that big. 20 or 30 pounds, usually is taken about that size. Sometimes you eat it that size. Depends on whether you eat it at 6 months, 15 months or 18 months. It has a very tall, about that tall stem, and the leaf is rather like Sagittaria and about that big. Has a spot there in the leaf where the stalk joins, and sometimes the leaf comes around that spot.
The stuff they call elephant ear.
It's the same family as elephant ear.
Oh, it's not the same
thing. No, colocasia is elephant ear. Alocasia is elephant ear. This is colocasia esculenta. The root is edible, and the leaves are edible if you cook them. You only ever eat a raw taro leaf once in your life.
Is elephant ear, though, that plant, is that edible too, or not?
Yes, it is. Just pinch a little bit off and eat it, and you regret it forever. In the leaves of this family, which are Araceae, the lilies, Araceae, they have spicules of, what's that acid in rhubarb?
Oxalic
acid, and they're needle-like, and they stick into your tongue and your throat, and it's like being pierced with 100 acid needles, and it's there for hours, so never eat these raw. When you cook it, it destroys the oxalic acid, and it's perfectly edible. Steam it for about 15 minutes.
Is the taparoa the light green leaf? I've grown both of these as ornamentals of that name, the elephantiera and the what I call the taro.
I want to talk about taro. It's an important crop to us. It's time we started to move it in throughout Australia. It will grow from here north. Here it may need a little bit of assist. You may need a plastic hoop over it. Although I had it growing quite well in the swamp. The boys went in and mulched it down. You didn't see it. It's now down 10 feet under mulch. This stuff doesn't seed. It's very rare for it to seed. It's been in cultivation so long, it's almost all vegetatively propagated. There's 1,100 varieties known to us, and there are probably more. They range from very large light leaf to small reddish leaf varieties. The edible leaf varieties are known by their Hawaiian name as luau taro, which are edible leaves. And they're grown for continual plucking. They're grown as a green spinach. And they don't form a very big root, although the roots are too edible, but you just grow these to eat. And they're mainly Japanese in origin, and they have a pink rib and a pink belly button here. Rio means belly button in Hawaiian. And they often name these from their belly buttons, whether the leaf encloses it, or whether it's on its own, or whether it's white or pink or something. It's an easy identification system. The edible taros are of two sorts, the root taros. One is ferment taro, and the other one is a dry taro for eating. Baking or shredding or making excellent chips out of. In fact, in Hawaii, the chips you buy are taro chips, not potato chips. They're better than potato chips. Again, the root contains spicules too of acid, and you never carry them on a bare back. You just always put a good thick shirt on to carry taro, sack of taro, because the spicules actually go into your flesh and smart, and then you've got to get a big knife and scrape your back down. I was last being scraped down by an old Hawaiian, they call a kahuna, an old medicine man, had his big knife out, and I'm standing there like this, and he scraped me down. He looks at the road, he says, I don't know what all these tourists will think about an old Hawaiian attacking this white fella with a big knife, he says. So we're giggling away there, a couple of old wretches we got. So these are, the ferment taro is, slightly different between a floury and a solid potato. Now this one's an important one for food. You cook it up and you mash it up and you stack it down in pots for 3 days when it develops a lot of vitamin B and becomes an excellent food and is a staple food of the Samoans and Hawaiians and the Pacific Islanders, and as a lot of white people have learned to eat and enjoy a poi. Poi is the taro ferment. A lot of my friends in Hawaii are poi maniacs. It originally looks like pink chewing gum and tastes like vinegar chewing gum. After a while, you start to get a little bit fond of it, and you do well to get fond of it because in the tropics, it's a high-quality food. The dry taros we can all eat and enjoy because you treat them like potatoes. Fry them or bake them, boil them. We should all be developing more of these water plants.
And all those will grow down here?
The propagation of the taro is rather easy. The big central root is there. It has a lot of little roots form around it all the time. Little shoots come off. You just break these off. Cut it. The thing about taro, you can eat it and have it too. When you cut the stem off, you leave a little bit of root on and just take a slanting cut on that, and that's the bit you put back in the water. So you're always cutting and replanting taro. This is called a keki, or child of the taro. It's such an old crop and it has so much culture associated with it that every part of every stem is named. And every variety is named, and it's discussed. And people are sitting there talking about taro, and the parts of taro, the sorts of taro. You get into that culture, it's really fantastic. It's also a very nice culture. I think the most pleasant gardening there is, taro patches.
Well, there's a couple of types. One, you can replant the culture part of the stem, and there's another
part
that you can slice
it
up
in
all the different sections
before
you get a growing nice.
I didn't know that.
To replant.
Taro.
So, otherwise, you don't get one for one every time.
Oh, no. You get the main keki, and you get every one of the kekis off the little roots. Off a taro, you normally get 8-20 kekis, and they're 10 cents each. They're no cost, and you can have them posted if you want them posted. You can arrange with your agricultural department to get them in. It's a sensible thing to do. Then they're sent in with a phytosanitary certificate. They put them through an iodine wash or something, and you get them in quite legally. There are a lot of taro growing in gardens throughout the east coast of Australia as ornamentals. People have brought them back from Hawaii, stuck them in their garden, watered them, mulched them, and they grow as a dryland ornamental. Yes, Fijians would be bringing them in flat out, no doubt.
How could you tell one in the garden the other one?
Elephant is a much larger plant with much less root. And it's normally grown as a forest understory plant and only harvested every 4 to 5 years. The root is rather small.
Sorry, just continue. I'm talking about an ordinary suburban garden. The elephant is everywhere.
Yes. They're huge things, much bigger than taro. The biggest taro is not as big as an elephant ear. They've got white veins through the leaf and they've got a relatively very small root. Otherwise, they belong in the Araceae. They're not... They're eaten on islands where taro doesn't occur. Yeah. So I would give taro your number one crop system in water, and then your water chestnuts, a lotus, excellent plant, roots, seeds. You can pop the seeds like popcorn. You eat the whole of the seed head transversely sliced. You've seen it canned. It's got little holes all through it. If you've ever eaten Chinese, you've eaten something that looks like that. It's the seed head. That's the seed head like that. And that's the transverse section of it. Lotus. And a beautiful plant. Now, when you start to look at what you can combine in aquaculture, what is absolutely missing from all books on aquaculture is the plant elements. Aquaculture has been treated as fish culture. Whereas there's an obvious thing, if I lived anywhere north, I would have a taro terrace system, and in the taro terrace I would have deeps, and at the outfalls I would have deeps. In the deeps I would rear fish, in the taro I'd rear pu'u. Over the whole damn thing I would put trellis, because the taro likes semi-shade. I'd be growing legumes along the buns here and having basically good diet of fish and mollusks, taro and leguminous beans and other crops. Yeah. I'll do it real good for you. Consider a set of terraces from low to high, and they can be step sideways across the slope. They each have a little bund. They have a little front wall on them sometimes, and there's another terrace there or something. You can make them real complicated. Water falls from one to the other. Where the water falls from the terrace, it oxygenates. You should then put a pond there, not a big pond, only 5 or 6 feet across and 4 feet deep. In those ponds you should grow shrimp, large prawns or good fish, and particularly herbivorous fish, because they don't eat the taro because of the acid. Taro across your whole pond. Taro water's about a foot deep. Azolla in the water, the tree fern, is your clover, water clover. That fixes your clover, your nitrogen for your taro crop. And azolla is a nitrogen-fixing fern of the water. There are 18 azolla species, and they cover from severely cold climates to equator. They have put water crop on perennial basis. You don't need to use anything but azolla for your nutrient base. Through the shallow water, your fish all graze at night. The taro gives you a good crop. Over these ponds, sticking out of your walls, you walk along your buns there. You can trellis out over them and grow a leguminous crop, which can also run into the water for your fish and prawns to eat. You can pick this anyhow from your taro bed and vine crop, and you're in heaven. And I reckon one or two of those and you're out of it for life. And the Hawaiians had a lot of those elements in it. The Hawaiians grew more fish in the taro patches than they ever caught in the sea. And it's estimated for the island of Molokai, they produced somewhere near 12 million pounds of fish out of the taro patches. They had also big enclosures in the sea from which they produced another 9 million pounds of mullet. But they never needed to go out to the reef and catch fish. The fish were right through their whole garden systems. Then since the Hawaiians had a lot of different peoples come to the island, they added pu'u, which they are pleased to get, and they've added azolla of recent years, which came in from China. And the last thing to add to the Hawaiian terraces is the trellis system.
Where did you put the pu'u in that system?
Pu'u goes right through the taro patch. The ducks can float up on the top terraces now, or the pigs, and the manure comes right down through the whole system. So there we have what I'd consider to be something like an integrated aquaculture with staple foods and a lot of other side foods, kangkong here and there and so on. I don't like it, but they come up again quite happily after it. You wait a little longer on your taro. It's very easy to give taro sufficient glasshouse to grow them, and then roll it off, I reckon, most of the time. They grow happily here right through until April, nearly May, and then they're down now, but they would be up again next week, so you only need some shelter. And of course with a water system, once you put glass over it, you don't have to worry about heat banks. You got it there. So I think, you know, maybe fish forage and human forage aquatic systems to me look like a very big future. How far we will be able to get with them, I don't know, but we're going to go as far as we can with it. Our main drive here is to develop still water aquatic systems. And in the end we'll do it, but I don't, as there's nobody ahead of us at present in the temperate zone, we'll be doing a lot of experimental work. Right. There's still water ponds may lack oxygen under the following conditions. If you have overstocked it with fish, if you have overfed it with manures, or if you've allowed too much vegetation to invade the pond, those three conditions. Therefore, you want to make fairly clean ponds for fish. You want to feed them very sparsely so that all the food you give them is cleaned up as you wait within half an hour. And then you want to stock them at a reasonable rate, and you don't run into that trouble. When you run into it, it's at night in summer. You hit the lowest oxygen base on summer nights. At that point, you can have an automatic oxygen meter in the water, and it can ring an alarm or flash a light or set a buzzer off near your ear, because it's got to be in bed. You'll be in bed when the oxygen... And you can turn on an oxygenator, which can be a pump. And what you do, very sensibly, is oxygenate a small section of the pond, which has an entry into which the fish can come. And the fish will then gather there for those few hours that they need to be in high oxygen water. Don't take them long to find it either. So you just oxygenate a very small section of the pond, and it's only probably three nights a year that you need to do that. That's very important with eels too. So it's best almost to put it on automatic, I feel. That your oxygen sensor starts a small pump, and that your oxygen starts to... You can either do it, you can, but what's the point? Because you don't need it nearly all the time. There is a wind-driven device. It's called wind. That's oxygenating at the point of times all day, you know. I don't see any point in overstocking and pumping oxygen all the time. You're on an energy loss system. I think if you stock correctly and pump oxygen only at very critical low oxygen periods, the old guy on eels said that maybe if you're unlucky, you'll pump oxygen for three nights a year. They didn't do any oxygenation except fall through the system. This isn't set up. I haven't seen taro patches set up as still water systems unless you're way out on ridges, in which case they mulch them as well. And you cut out the fish then. Natural oxygenation systems we've been through in sense of the troms. And if you're looking at a flow-through system, you just have trom systems along the flow-through. It would pay you to put a little primitive troms all through these little drops. So you're constantly getting water at full oxygen falling to each pond. The Hawaiians put splash rocks all the way down and do splash oxygenation.
You can do it another way too, use a drum and punch holes through it or something.
And shower the water onto your pond, increase the water surface area. It's much more efficient to include air bubbles in the water than to try and get the water to pick up oxygen. But showering isn't too bad, really. It's quite good to combine shower up here with a cone there, and then your water is not only picks up air, but includes air, and then pass that down to your pond. Oxygen in water causes... Our problem is not when the wind is blowing. We're going to get tons of oxygen when the wind is blowing. Our problem is on still summer nights when we won't get any help from the wind. It's possible that we could, if we had the money, set up a compressed air tank and let it bleed off during hot nights. But I think the sensible thing is to start something up on hot nights, pump air.
Well, if we could find out more about that chamber system, that pump up the water to a little level and then you could have that overflow running, because that operate on still
nights. Yeah, it's quite possible for us to use a header dam as our oxygenating system And what you do basically is turn on your water to shower into the ponds. I think that's something we're thinking about ourselves. To run a Trom system during the nights when we have low oxygen.
Could you run a pump and just have a bit of a polypipe or something just fall into the water? Would that be okay?
Generally all they do is pump air through a perforated pipe at the bottom of the pond and let the air curtain come up through the pond. The fish hang around in that air curtain for that period and then they leave as soon as the oxygen's high enough. It's not a big deal, except that you've got to have something that's out there on those nights that, you know, when you might lose your fish, that's all. And it's your fault anyhow, probably, that you put too many fish in the pond or too much food that was uneaten. So if you let natural eel systems, which ours will be self-stocked at the rate that the eels can stand. They know how much they can stand. Okay. Well, I hope that sort of helped you a bit in aquacultures. And also that you can get out there and design them. And that leads us to the world's most efficient agriculture, which has got a name. It's called Chinampa. I told you to listen for that name. Here we come. It was evolved and run for many centuries in the lake of Mexico City, which was Lake Teotihuacan. The lake, name of the lake is Smoking Mirror. That's the one that now surrounds Mexico City and where there are sad remnants of Chinampa. It was run and developed by the Aztec. It was the most complicated yield system, I think, of which we have any historical record. It consisted of the development of marshlands as a sort of harmonic, a water-air-earth harmonic, in which the water was that part of the system and the earth was up here. It's also modern and very well developed in Thailand and in Kashmir. They're the three areas, and in some of the high lakes in Peru. There are four areas you can see these systems are currently operating. The water system was used as the nutrient gathering system, and nutrient was taken there from water to land. It's used in Thailand, all around, yeah. You can find it by probing around Bangkok, in Kashmir, where most of the vegetables and a lot of fruits are produced on these systems. It's still around Mexico City, in Mexico. And it's used in the Peruvian highlands. And it has variations. There's a constant sort of land-to-water nutrient exchange. Fish are grown in the water. Waterfowl are integral to the system. Ducks. Crop is grown on the land surface, and that ranges from tree crop to vegetable crop. And mud is scooped from the ponds to the land, and it's quite handy. You're just right beside it. You can add azolla to that and stop scooping so much mud, just scoop the azolla up. And its production is higher than any system we know about. There's obviously you have no irrigation problem.
How wide would the water channel be?
It's up to you. You can run different harmonics, and I think it's very sensible to run some deeper channels and broader earth. And to specify these for different crops. The harvesting is usually done very wisely in shallow boats so that your load carrying is pretty minimal. Just pole along. The Kashmiris add trellis. The Mexicans didn't. The Thais don't. Thais run very even systems of about 2 meter intervals. About 2 meters. I got some photographs of them. I guess they're about 6 feet wide, earth to water. Pretty constant cropping. Of course, your earth, if it's not too high above the water, it shouldn't exceed 2 feet elevation, 2'6", 30 inches. About 30 inches maximum, I'd say at the middle here, is constantly irrigated. And will grow good trees. No trees that won't grow there.
What do you mean, kind of ergo that just seeps in?
It just does, yeah. Yeah.
About 2 meters wide.
Yeah. You can make them lower and wider. You can make 24 inches above water level and 20 feet wide, and they're still quite damp enough to grow. That's it. That's the best system you could get. I mean, you just have to start to imagine what you can do on those. The mind boggles. I mean, you just go home and draw that thing there and put glass houses over it and trellises over it and play with big crop land to water systems, small fruit systems. I mean, if you're going to set up for a blueberry growing or any of those things, you probably run a pine chinampa with some of the tamaracks and other water pines, Pinus palustris, blueberry edges, take your pine stuff off and run blueberry chinampa with pine mulch, you know, just let your old mind rave over this one. I have sat down and, you know, I have many evenings sat down and designed different chinampa systems until I figure it's so damn complicated you might as well just do what you want to do.
You get the harmonic pattern, the plan form through there, forming all the channels are linked.
Yeah, you can link your channels so that your channel systems are like that. There is an awful lot of landscape that we can chinampa. It doesn't have to be level. It can be a descending landscape in chinampa. Then you have to have overfalls from channel to channel. Wherever you can get a trickle of water in at the top, you're into chinampa. If you can't get a trickle of water in, you have to head for the swamps, because then you're into chinampa as a fact, as a matter of them being swamps.
What you could do would be have a
gather. We're going to set them up. When we get our machine this year, Dave's going to go around and chinampa, you know, 20 acres or something. God knows what we'll do with it. One of the things that we've thought of is that here is a place to grow blackberries and bamboo also. But blackberries are a damn nuisance in that everywhere they touch the ground, they send down roots. Whereas on isolated chinampa systems in swamp, the blackberries love it, and the roots just die as they hit the water, and you can walk along in shallow water and you get the best blackberries, huge yields. So we are looking now at some of those fierce, thorny blackberries of fantastic yield, which you don't want in your garden, but you like to have, and we've got some of them. Friends of ours are growing them, and we might grow, you know, 100 yards of those.